Okay, we are live in the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse in the landmark cast iron building in Greenwich Village, New York at 67 East 11th Street. We would like to thank everybody for coming out tonight, along with our terrific author and editor, Matthew Stevenson. This is how we start all podcasts. For those of you who have never been here before, welcome. To those who have been to the clubhouse before, welcome home. It's an honor to have Matthew Stevenson with us tonight. Those in the crowd know Matthew much better than I do, but for those listening on the podcast, just a little quick mini bio. Matthew Stevenson was born in New York City and grew up on Long Island, attending Buckley Country Day School and Friends Academy. His university degrees are from Bucknell and Columbia Universities, and he spent a year abroad with the Institute of European Studies in London and Vienna. He moved to Geneva, Switzerland in 1991 and worked in banking until 2004. He is a contributing editor to Harper's Magazine and the host of The Travel Hour, a radio program. His articles and essays have appeared in numerous publications in the U.S. and Europe. And it's a pleasure to welcome you to the clubhouse tonight.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you for not just welcoming me, but welcoming my friends as well.
All right, thank you. We love when the friends are enthused, so it's perfect.
The beer is flowing.
It works quickly, apparently. So let's since this is the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse, most of our discussions center around baseball. Sometimes they take unexpected detours, but that's where we'll start. And in a couple of your books, Remembering the 20th Century Limited and Rules of the Game, which is a collection of essays from Harper's Magazine, you express an affection for the way baseball was in the 1960s and earlier. Talk a little bit about that, how you became a baseball fan, and what baseball was like for someone who did grow up in New York in that era.
Well, thank you, Jay. I mean, I think that if I could invoke the 60s, and it doesn't seem as though it was 40, 50 years ago, but it was. And I think my first baseball games were in the early 1960s, probably Yankee Stadium in 61, but almost more appropriate for the baseball gallery here is in 1962 when the Mets began playing as a team. I went with my grandmother. Her name was Helen Gray. And we went to the old Polo Grounds, which Polo Grounds were at about 155th Street across the river from Yankee Stadium. And the Mets were an expansion team. They were just up from AAA. And I remember Bill Shepard's here in the audience, and Bill Shepard grew up a Phillies fan, but so he remembers Richie Ashburn, who was an original Met. But Tony Taylor was the second baseman for the Mets. And if you looked out to center field, when they took out a starting pitcher, he didn't just get sort of a pat on the back and walk into the dugout. He'd turn and walk along through center field. And there was, I think it was about 517 feet in dead center field at the Polo Grounds, which is a country mile. And there was a set of stairs that went up to a door. So it had this kind of almost Dante's Inferno or purgatory. You were banished, not just to the dugout in the way, or driven out in a car the way some of the relievers are now. You went out, you ascended to some netherworld. And that was my first experience. And then through the 60s, as some of those know here, at Yankee Stadium, at later Shea Stadium, because the Polo Grounds ceased to exist in 64, and never went to Ebbets Field, although I own a picture of Ebbets Field, and I think that's the origin of some of them. But I think I always had a literary association with baseball. I don't think I'm a true fan and that I don't go to 100 games a year. I think in some ways my childhood, reading Matt Christopher books about baseball, John Tunis, the boys' books of baseball. I liked reading about baseball and later writing about baseball probably as much as watching baseball. So my friend Tom is here, and we've had countless hours of baseball conversation, but I only think we've been to one game together, which was Dwight Gooden's 1986 debut with the Mets, or kind of early debut with the Mets, when Tom said, he said, you know, there's a great new pitcher for the Mets, and I think we ought to go see him. Can you get me a ticket?
Well, you picked a good guy to go see. You mentioned that your grandmother, it was your grandmother?
My grandmother, yes.
Yeah, which, just out of interest, usually, obviously not always, but many times it's a father, grandfather. Here you have a grandmother taking you to your first game.
My grandmother spent her, I think she was a victim of the Depression, as many people were. I think her husband, he worked in railroads, he was for the Chicago and Alton. He was a passenger agent. And after the Depression, I think he was literary. I think the one book I have of his that has his name in it are the notebooks of Mark Twain, and they're annotated. And he had, I think they spent their 50s at the Polo Grounds, dressed in a tie, probably a dress, you know, getting sort of general admission tickets, going to the game. The game had a kind of feeling of church, or kind of, not that it was solemn, but they. And he died in 1960, and she moved in with us. And what she brought to the house was a love of Willie Mays. So we would dinner with my grandmother wasn't statistics. It was just that if only baseball could come back to New York. And when it came in 1962, when the Mets began, there's a fabulous book by Jimmy Breslin about Casey Stengel called Can't Anyone Play This Game Around Here, which is the great memoir of the 62 Mets. For her, she thought that the Giants were coming back. In a way, she thought her childhood was coming back. She thought that her life would get younger, and it wasn't. So there was a sadness. You know, baseball's probably about death in some ways. And for her, she wanted to keep what she had in the 50s with her husband at the Polo Grounds. And it wasn't, you know, they tore down the Polo Grounds, they moved to Shea Stadium. She loved the Mets, and she loved me. And the games were on at 2 in the afternoon. Baseball wasn't a night sport then. And I'd get home from, I can tell you when I got home from school, and see, I watched the clock go 2:41, 2:42, 2:43, 2:44, 2:45, and I could go home. And I'd bike home instantly, and she had the games on. And I'd go to her room, which was Simon and Tom and Maggie and Bill, been to the Sands Point house. She was on the second floor in what was called Grandma's room, and that had always had a baseball game on.
It's a beautiful memory.
Well, I think baseball is partly about memory. I mean, I think that it's a way to relate to generations, and I probably spent a little too much time thinking about baseball as it was or as it should be, a little less as it is. I probably do poorly with reality.
Well, that probably makes two of us, which is why the clubhouse does not focus on the current modern-day player, basically. Speaking about the 62 Mets, am I correct that you met the manager, Casey Stengel, at some point?
I met Casey Stengel twice, believe it or not. Not that Casey Stengel met me, I met him. I was 8 or 9 years old. Let's see, I was 10 years old. It was 1964. Casey Stengel, for those on the podcast that may be younger, let's hope it's younger listeners, had played for the New York Giants and the Dodgers as a player and was a longtime manager in both leagues, but managed the Yankees from 49 to 1961 or two. Was it, when did Ralph Houk take over?
Yeah.
I think in 60 was his last year. And a friend of mine was Dick Seaman, who was an editor of Time Inc., and he had dugout passes, and his son Nick and I were friends, and we went to the Shea Stadium as it opened up, and it didn't seem unusual to me, so we had tickets to the dugout. So we went in the dugout, and Stengel was not that tall, and there's only great Stengel stories. Once he's playing for the Mets and the Dodgers and they lose, and he goes to the barber shop and he said, can I give you a shave? He said, no, I might like to cut my throat on my own. And he wrote his wife once, he said, I like this city, but he said, there's not enough bridges for me to jump off after the games. And Stengel spoke in this kind of stream of consciousness. Look, I was 10 years old, he was a manager of the Mets, he was, as Warren Spahn was a Met in the early 60s, and Warren Spahn was a won a lot of games, I think 350 games or something, maybe more, 369. And he played for Casey Stengel as a Brave, I believe, in the 40s, and then as a Met in the 60s. And he said, I played for Casey before and after he was a genius. So Casey shook our hands, but there was, it's all he did. I mean, he didn't sit and say, you know, what do you think about today's lineup? But there was a, if you read the Robert Creamer biography of Stengel, which I just bought at the Strand for my friend Doug Adler for Christmas, it's just a lovely description of Casey Stengel's life. I think it, in some ways the Creamer biography is the best writing on the best subject if you want to live in the 1920s and 30s of Casey Stengel. But there's a hardness about Stengel. He wants to win. And he said, this is a podcast, but it's, and presumably everyone who's over 18 can handle a Stengel story. He said of his players who were out, carousing, he said, I don't mind them getting it. He said, what I mind is them staying up all night looking for it. And so I met Stengel that first time, shook his hand, and then, as my friend Jeff Anderson's here from my grammar school, the Mrs. Payson's grandson was on our team in our class, and the team went to the Mets dugout a year or two later. Stengel must have been fired about 65, I would say, 60, 65, yeah. 66, and he was then a little more kind of wizened as a figure, but I think that there's a famous story of Stengel who testified in front of Congress about antitrust or gambling or something, and he went with Mickey Mantle. It was a big celebrity, and he just talked, like I'm talking now, stream of consciousness for about 35 minutes, and they said thank you, and then they said, Mickey, what are your views? And he said, my views are just about the same as Casey's.
Yeah, that you can actually get all. You can find that, I believe, on the internet. It's hilarious.
Yeah, you get the live now. My friend Doug Adler, who's a link to the 1962 Mets. He's a friend, lives in Washington, and we've been friends a long time. And I found that his father had been the public relations manager of the 62 Mets. He was the PR guy, and he grew up in the, he was 10 or something. He was in the same dugout at the same time. And so when I asked, we were talking about today, and I reminded him about this player on the Mets named Marvelous Marv Thronberry, who's hopeless, but lovable, because he was a 62 Met, and he hit a triple, and he's standing on third base, and they appealed to first base, and he was called out because he hadn't stepped on first base. And Casey came out to argue the call, and Solly Hemus, I reminded Doug, was the coach on third, and he took Casey by the arm and said, he said, what is this, crazy? He said, didn't touch first. He said, forget it, Casey, didn't touch second either.
Well, since I'm a Mets fan, let's stick with the Mets for a little bit. So these are, I'm jealous in the sense that I was too young to remember the 62.
And I'm jealous because I feel I'm too old.
But I do remember, as a child, the 69 Mets, when things all of a sudden changed. And I believe you met a few of those.
In the late 67, 68, 69, Jeff and I's mutual friend, mutual classmate, Dan DeRelay's grandmother was Mrs. Payson. She's a legendary figure. She's the bridge between the Giants at the Polo Grounds, whom she loved like my grandmother. She loved... and bringing the Mets and baseball back to New York. And once or twice a year, she would take the Little League team at the time, or the junior high school team. And it was 67, 68. So it's Jerry Kuzman, Nolan Ryan, Tom Seaven. My memory of Bud Harrelson, who was the shortstop and quite a scrappy player, is I was small for my age, and his batting helmet fit me. And so we would get to the play. This was long before the games would start, probably 2 hours before the games. The player, Yogi Berra, was a coach on those teams, and it was a sort of a end of childhood experience that Yogi would smoke in the dugout in the runway down. I thought, geez, baseball players, they don't smoking. So it was the Seaver looked like a kind of California lifeguard. I mean, I'm just kind of, it's pictures in an exhibition. Yeah. They're not saying, you guys want to chew a little. There's tobacco stains just right along the dugout rail there. There was a second baseman named Jerry Buchek. I don't know if you remember him, if you're a real Mets fan. Lovely. He just kind of, hey, you guys, didn't I see you last year? He was just an engaging presence. Ed Charles was the third baseman, right, and gregarious and fun. And at some point, my mother, as we were cleaning out, she died, sadly, this summer, so many know here. As I was going through her stuff, I found the picture of a 13-year-old Matthew surrounded by three or four Mets. I think the manager, 67's Wes Westrom, maybe?
Even Gil Hodges.
Gil Hodges took over. Hodges is, I don't have a memory of, I have a memory of being in the dugout, and a fan, you could just walk down, brings pickle juice for Nolan Ryan, because Nolan Ryan apparently would immerse his hand in pickle juice. Right. And he said, I've got pickle juice for Nolan. Well, if you did that today, Homeland Security would arrest you. The Bush family would have you incarcerated somewhere in Karachi. And the cops said, really? This is for Nolan. Wait a minute. And he took the pickle juice, went back into the dugout, said, okay, he's got it. So there was an intimacy with players, I think, that's a bit lost in this more corporate age.
Oh, absolutely. Unfortunately. Well, those are great memories of the Mets through the 60s, from the worst to the best in that short time frame.
The memory I have of 69 is the Cubs collapsing as much as the Mets kind of rallying. You might have the same. What was your first season?
Well, my first game, it was 1964. My dad took me to Shea Stadium when it was built. But I was too young to, I mean, all I remember is leaving the game with my dad, holding his hand and having a little Mr. Met doll in my other hand. So walking down those giant concrete corridors, which seemed like the Coliseum.
Right, yeah.
That's my first memory. I was 9 when the Mets won in 69, so
mm-hmm.
This is how they do it. You know, I didn't know that, all right, that was going to be my one great summer except for one other one. You know, who knew at the time? But I'm always jealous that I would hear these stories from my dad about Casey Stengel, and I'm always jealous that I didn't get to let alone meet him, even briefly, that I didn't get to witness his...
I think he had a kind of an intimacy with his players, even at his age, that was based on a kind of a boy. I think he never, he's Peter Pan. He never grew up. He just loved putting on the uniform and being in the game. And Marv? Maybe Tom remembers Marv. Whom did he say? He's 20, and in 10 years, he has a chance to be 30.
Right. Exactly. Well, one of the other things I always think about, I used to talk to my dad about this, is, you know, if a manager is a great manager or not. And basically, if you don't have the horses, you can't be a great manager. And in the two of the worst managers in New York Mets history, if you just go by their records, are Casey Stengel and Joe Torre. Arguably two of the greatest managers in Yankee history.
Well, they asked Stengel the keys to managing, and he said, on the team, five guys like you and five guys hate you, and five haven't made up their mind. And he said the trick of managing is keeping the five guys that hate you from the five guys that haven't made up their minds. I think that applies to other circumstances. What's the trick of a book reading? Keeping the five guys...
He knew. Well, speaking of baseball books, let's discuss a little bit about one of the most, probably the book that changed baseball books, if not other types of literature forever, which is Ball 4, which you write about in Remembering the 20th Century Limited and Rules of the Game, Jim Boughton's book, Ball 4. If you could just talk a little bit about that. When did you first read it? When did you meet Jim? The impact it had on you and the impact it had on literature in general or sports writing. If you could just talk a little bit about that.
Well, you're hitting now on a marital subject, because my wife Connie thinks it's at some point I ought to get rid of a few of my books, that the books from my childhood might be moved to some other place than her house. But I remember it was the summer of about 1970 or 71. I think Wolf War comes out in the summer of 1970, perhaps. I think it's about the 69 season. I was in the 10th grade, and it was a new hardback book. And I don't really think I'd ever gone to a bookstore and put down $5.95 and bought it and took it home. And I think, as Jeff and I did, we had summer reading in those years. You had to read The Mayor of Casterbridge, Jude the Obscure, Little Dorrit, and, you know, The Return of the Native. That was what a private school thought was. And I couldn't read any of that. What I did is I went to the flashlight under the covers of my bed and read Ball 4 about five or six times. And Ball 4 is a romp. It's, at the time, it was thought, well, he said it was, it broke every mold. It was a player, in a way, just turning in other players on what happened in the clubhouse. As he said, they're 25-year-old men with the mind of a 15-year-old boy. You know, is that the famous expression from Ball 4's Shooting Beaver, which describes looking into the open hotel rooms of presumably women in some state of undress. It sounds pretty unappealing to me, but I guess if you were a New York Yankee in 1965, that passed for humor, because Mickey Mantle and Whitey Ford were the architects of the Beaver patrols. But it was more the Bull Four. There's a language. Jim Bouton, I think, I once asked him how he writes, and he says, I don't write with my fingers the way other people, maybe Simon or Penn, or he said he speaks it. He speaks his words, and as he talks and interviews himself, and as he's talking, he writes down what he's listening to. So the style of Bull Four is wonderfully evocative of speech. Of baseball, I think baseball is a lot about speech, and the pleasure of baseball is language, and he captures just the delights. The one of the phrases in Ball 4 is "pound." You're going to have to pound Bud. Joe Schultz, the manager of the Seattle, he's always pounding Bud, and when he trades Lou Piniella, he says you're going to have to pound your Bud somewhere else. And the pitching coach has one piece of advice in Ball 4, which is smoke him inside. And that's all it is, just smoke them inside. And if you haven't reread Ball 4, if you've just missed it, you can go on, I think it's jimbouton.com. He lives near Setsuko and Simon up in the Berkshires, and get him to sign a copy for you and send it, you know, it'll say to, you know, Jay Goldberg, and it's got his life every 10 years after it was sold. It sold 5 million copies in paperback, hardback, you know, I think 500,000 or something. And I think that as literature, it was voted one of the 50 or top 100 influential books of the century.
Right.
And so it's been a when I was writing about his new book called Foul Ball, which is about Wacona Park in Pittsfield, which is in one of the books there, I called him up and thought, and that led, he had family in Amsterdam, and we had two or three lunches in Amsterdam on a canal. Wow. So you kind of think, well, you live in Europe, how can you even think about baseball? But if baseball's literature, you live anywhere. And I associate Jim with Amsterdam, not with Yankee Stadium. But he has an ability. The Foul Ball is about politics and about the stadium there and not being the stadium. They wanted to kind of turn it into independent baseball, which was heresy. And he wrote it up. He wrote up the little local political structures. He once wrote up, you know, the Yankees or the Pilots and the Yankees. But I still think that, you know, the pleasure, the strand is around the corner. If you can go back and find some of these old books, it's one of the pleasures of baseball.
Absolutely. And if you could just talk a little bit about that, about some of the other baseball books that have influenced your writing or that you've just have thoroughly enjoyed.
I mean, the book that comes to mind that I knew about when I was 11, the summer of 1965, roughly. Give or take. Connie said, "Stop that. Just say the '60s." in summer of 1965, this friend Nick Seaman, we only watched baseball, the Yankees, the Mets, whatever was on. And Dick Seaman, who'd taken us to see Casey Stengel, he was the Time editor, still living, still lives in Annapolis, about 93, 92, and he and I write back and forth. And he said, the best book about baseball is The Glory of Their Times. And he, you know, he had, but it looked like an adult book. It looked thick and long. It took me a long time to get to The Glory of Their Times. And when I got to it, I discovered it was about many things, baseball in part, but it was really an oral history of America in the teens and in the 20s. And that led me to, which I think Bill, I gave to Bill Shepard, I think it's on his computer in his, because he downloaded it when he was visiting us, the original tapes that he made of you know, Glory of Their Times, Lawrence Ritter. You can now buy as a DVD. So you hear the Chief Myers, and it's just about the train and about baseball, and it's a sandlot experience of them. It's everything America isn't anymore. You know, now it's kind of, you play for Arizona State and you're kind of bred at the Tucson Sports Academy, and cybermetrics govern whether you're a second baseman or a third baseman. And this is about guys carrying what they call grips, you know, small satchels, to small ballparks like Wacona, like Newark, like, you know, Wheeling, West Virginia, and playing two games all week, you know, all weekend long. And so I like Lawrence Ritter. I think that the biographies by Robert Creamer, if that's how you say his name, the Babe Ruth biography, is just a fabulous account of Babe Ruth's life. There have been others, and maybe that's not the best. It suited me, and that Babe Ruth endlessly amuses me. And when I went to the Babe Ruth Museum with Bill, and I think Alan went, I think, no, Bill. Bill and I went to the Babe Ruth Museum. I wrote to Connie and I said, better than the Louvre. And she didn't come back to me on that one. And
she agreed.
The Babe, I like, the Babe's fondness for women is, I use his phrase, when the Babe was going to see someone, he said, I'm going to see a party. So when our children go out, I say to Connie, is he going to see a party? So, I mean, I think that books, I relate to baseball as much as anything through its literature. And I just bought Vec is in Rec. Vec is in Rec.
Right.
I'm endlessly searching for kind of a lyrical narrative of baseball. And when I find one that I love, I cherish it. And then I find others that fall flat. I just bought a book about the world tour, that Spalding world tour of baseball that he took. He goes to Australia and Europe and to promote the empire of baseball. And so far, I'm on page 100 for about 3 months, which isn't a good sign.
Stuck in the third inning.
Exactly.
Speaking of what was and what is, do you follow baseball today still?
Oh, and sadly, intensively. And I'll describe my relationship to baseball. As everyone knows here, but now our podcast knows, I pretty much live for my bicycles. And I ride everywhere, and I'm missing it tonight. And ride through cities, ride through the country. And one of the things that I do is when I'm coming back from work in the evenings in Switzerland, there's a podcast called Baseball Today, which is inane baseball chatter, which is exactly the length of my commute, 47 minutes. And I put the buds in on my ears, and I bike through the Swiss countryside reviewing everything that happened yesterday in baseball. And if I don't listen to it, I feel a little bereft. I don't love the modern game of baseball. I don't like the money. I don't like the contracts. I don't like the economics. I think baseball is kind of going to go broke. I mean, I think that there's something... I don't know, just the, you just don't, I relax, that small town America doesn't have baseball, you know, that there isn't a game, there isn't small games in towns on Sunday is a loss. It's become a oligopoly. It's 26 teams. It's kind of fixed contracts. You have to pay a guy $26 million to play for you, not play that well. There's something wrong. So that part of baseball just doesn't. In a way, it has the baseball that I live in is nothing to do with paying $1.2 billion for a new Yankee Stadium. And I went to the new Yankee Stadium, since it's maybe come up in the question. Have you been? What do you think? I hated it, but I hated it for this reason. I was finished an unpleasant day in New York. I thought, I'm going to go to this new Yankee Stadium. Bill and I talked about it. He said, you got to go. I got on the subway. I went to the, bought a ticket for $5, which is the Stevenson and me. On Tuesdays in March or whatever, you can buy a ticket for $5. I walked up to the gate. I said, here I am, all the way from Switzerland, Yankee Stadium. They said, yes, sir. Welcome to Yankee Stadium. Ripped my ticket in half, said, what's in your pocket? And I said, a Kindle. And they said, we don't allow people in with Kindles. They thought that somehow during, in the seventh inning stretch, instead of singing God Bless America, I'd read The Glory of Their Times, right? And they wouldn't let me in. I asked for the man, I asked for the librarian. And what was I going to do with my Kindle? I wanted to see the new Yankee Stadium. I stood there for four innings while successive managers all explained to me the heresy of trying to enter the house that Steinbrenner built. Explain that one to me. Is it, they thought I was, one of the guys said, well, you'll be reading your Kindle and a foul ball will get you. I've dreamed my whole life of catching a foul ball. And if this Kindle's going to get me any closer to a foul ball, that's good. Did they think I was going to kind of read Karl Marx? I had a newspaper and that was okay. But so my advice to podcast listeners is don't go to the, I did get in. I brooded on that one for three innings and I stormed off in a mild huff and went to the next gate and gave him my ripped ticket in half and said, here I am. And they said, welcome to Yankee Stadium. And I haven't been to the new Shea Stadium, but I had a 45 minutes between two meetings on Long Island, and I was coming back, and I thought, I can talk my way into the new Shea Stadium. New, what is it called?
City Field.
Stadiums are only named after companies going out of business.
Exactly.
Or when they name, the only time to sell a stock is when you see its name up on the stadium lights. So MetLife, get rid of it. So I went to the, I saw it, I looked into the gates there at City Field, like a kind of, like in a novel, I was sort of peering up into this Nuremberg space, and there were pictures of Dodgers.
Jackie Robinson.
Where's Ron Swoboda? Where's Art Shamsky? Where's Lee Mazzilli? Where's Mookie Wilson? Jackie Robinson? It's Harris. Anyway, so I did, and I talked to the guard. I said, I don't have a Kindle. Can you let me in? And he said, no. If you had a Kindle, we'd let you in.
That's great. Well, before we get to the question and answers, my last question would be, since we're talking about these different ballparks, is there one particular ballpark that you've been to that is your favorite?
Yes, I have three favorites, and I'll give them to you in order. My first favorite is Princeton University School Field. My mother was deathly sick. I left her bedside. Jeff visited her many times, knows what it was like. I couldn't deal with it anymore. I got on my bike. I biked to the Princeton University baseball field. It was the Ivy League championship doubleheader. I sat on the grass. There was a little beer. And I sat next to two professional scouts who were scouting the players. We talked endlessly for 2 hours about baseball. The game took place as close as the bleachers are to us, and it was what I wanted baseball to be, a kind of a bucolic Thomas Hardy sense of kind of, that part, Southwest England, more than I wanted to be in a kind of corporate stadium. I love that state. That's not a stadium. There's in Trenton, there's a minor league thing, and Charles and I, is my son, and Henry, we all went to it, and when a foul ball is hit at Trenton Stadium, the ball goes over the roof because it's not very high, and on the organ or the sound system at Trenton, they play the sound of breaking glass. And in Maine, where my wife's from, there's a Portland stadium, and they have two contests. There's a Portland dog. The team is the Sea Dogs, but he's a real dog, not a sea dog. And the fan races the dog around the bases. Usually the dog wins, but sometimes he gets distracted. I think there was one game we went to. There was a cat in the outfield. And they have a lobster toss between innings. I think I like the baseball. My idea to reform baseball is I want to get rid of the outfield wall. I think if baseball had an endless quality, that if you had to play the outfield, you could always catch the long home runs, but singles would drop in front of you. And the game, as I imagine it, was infinite. The reason the diamond is diamond-shaped is it went out, it was endless. And I think that if I'd love to see a professional baseball game where there was no outfield wall and see how interesting the game would be. And, I think that the fence is a sort of the industrialization of baseball in 1890 or whatever. But I bet the early games were played in fields of dreams.
Yeah, the photos I've seen from that time, the wall, there is no wall, it's just people. Yeah, it's all the fans out there. And
that would be an interesting game. Think about it. You could play way back, and you could catch A-Rod's towering drives, but if you're playing back there, you can hit singles all day. It would be an interesting game.
Yeah, no, I agree. Unfortunately, in today's game, the wall is littered with advertising, and they keep bringing the fences in so players can hit home runs easier.
Yeah.
So I think it's something we may both wish for that may not happen.
A game on stimulants, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, do we have any questions from our audience?
Yes, I have just a quick question about the lack of a wall. You can catch the long drive, but how about the quirky singles that bounce off a guy's glove? You might have quite a few home runs, but that's really not the question. The question is, Matthew and I have talked about sports a lot, but never about books and sports. And I'm curious, Matthew, you've got two very good books written by a Cincinnati relief pitcher, Pennant Fever and Championship Season, which predate Bowden. And they're about the inside of baseball.
And who's the author?
I think it was Jerry Holzman. I won't swear to it, but I think it was. But the question I want to ask you, and this is a literary question, it involves Don DeLillo and Pafko at the Wall. For those of you who have read Underworld, you know that the first section of the book is about Thompson's home run hit off Branko, and it's from Pafko's point of view. He was playing left field. But also, Don DeLillo has Tuck Shaw, Jackie Gleason, and J. Edgar Hoover in DeRosa's box. And for 80 pages, we have that inning, that last inning of the playoff game, and what these fellows were talking about. And only Don DeLillo knows, no one else. And I think it's the greatest piece of literature about baseball. And Lewis Lapham, someone not unknown to all of us, ran it as the first colored supplement in Harper's Magazine, as 60 pages, about a year after, 6 months after Don published. It's the first part of Underworld. I'm just curious if you think, or you may disagree, if that is not the greatest literary use of a baseball scene in modern American baseball.
Tom, it could be, and I have read other things by DeLillo and admired them. And if somebody sent it to me, they said, this is the great, just said what you did, this greatest piece of literature about baseball, and Xeroxed it on little Xerox, sent it to me, and I carried it around for a year, and I didn't get anywhere with it, which is me, not Don DeLillo. And that's we all know when some books we hit at the right moment, at the right time in our lives, and we think, this book will sing with me forever. And other books that, other books that you want to admire and you don't. So for me, for you, yes, and for other people, the person who sent it to me, Michael Martin, who's the co-editor on Rules, he's the one who sent it to me. In a literary sense, I remember, it's years since I've read The Natural, and I remember it being somewhat dark, and I'm not sure I love baseball as fiction. I think I like baseball as I know it. I mean, I like the memoir, I like the speech, I like the carny aspects of baseball. That's why, you know, Vec is in Rec. And when sometimes when, like, Field of Dreams, the novel, I think is, it was, I can't remember the writer, but it was published by Houghton Mifflin years. It seems kind of precious to me sometimes. So that's my bias is for kind of the trains of the, you know, the trains that the Babe and Lou Gehrig ride across Indiana, and the speech is the literary highlights to me.
Do you know a novel by Jay Nugaghorn called Sam's Legacy, where Babe Ruth ends up having an affair with a black male janitor?
Is that considered a party?
But it's a wonderful novel.
The Babe of Babe was ecumenical in his interests.
Do we have any other questions or comments from our grandstand?
Where's the Babe Ruth Museum?
The Babe Ruth Museum is as it should be, is over a bar and grill in Baltimore. It's thought that the Babe was an orphan and he was sent to St. George's School for Wayward Boys, was where he was educated. I may not be St. George's, I think it's St. George. Anyway, it's a reform school run by Franciscans, or, you know, and his parents are both living. They both run this bar and grill. And it was just that he was too wild. They just couldn't, you know, just, we can't deal with this kid anymore. You deal with him. And he goes there from age 12 to 18, and he's a sensation at baseball. And he's gregarious. And he becomes, that's his growing up. And when he leaves the school there in Baltimore, do you remember if it's called St. George's?
I believe so, yes.
One of the fathers takes him by the arm or something and says, George, which was Babe Ruth's real name, he said, "You'll make it, George." And I thought it was a lovely kind of American historical passage of the Babe kind of entering. And he plays a year for the Baltimore Americans, who are a minor league semi-professional, and just, you know, the tears. And then he's a pitcher. He pitches for the Boston Red Sox, the favorite team of Patty Anderson, Jeff's mother, and her mother, in turn, Mrs. Matz. And the Babe is the best pitcher in the history of baseball, almost, at that. He's a Hall of Fame pitcher for six or seven seasons. He has this, after Guidry has the most wins by a left-hander, you know, whoever played. It's just,
he's a great. He pitched them in 1916, the year that won.
With the pennant.
He both hit. And he
evolves, and then he's batting so much they think, well, let's get this guy in the lineup, and so they put him in the outfield, and then immediately, to raise money for the Broadway show No No Nanette, the owner of the Red Sox sells him to the Yankees for $100,000, about 21 maybe, something like that, 2021, and so the Babe lives on 72nd. And is it the Ansonia?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe that's 7066. They're one of the, anyway, that's, and he's, I don't know that he's home every night reading some of the magazines that Jay sells here in the gallery, but he's a man about town.
Do you know if the story is true or apocryphal? Supposedly the Babe had a check for $5,000 to $10,000, which he carried with him everywhere, in every bar. Drinks are on me, and he'd fumble in his pocket, check, and they say, "All right, Babe, you can't break it, we'll buy the drinks." He finally goes to cash the check after the Depression hits, and the check was worthless because the bank in which it was drawn had disappeared. But supposedly he carried this check around for about 10 years and got free drinks, and after making this grandiose statement.
The Babe was careful and fair with money. I mean, I do know that. And his advice to rookies was, don't be so eager to pick up checks. I hadn't heard about Babe and his five. It sounds a little kind of apocryphal, doesn't it? You know, I don't think the Babe was a cheapskate. And I think there was a lot of descriptions of him as a kind of a large child. He was on a barnstorming in Japan. And he went to dinner. Someone took him to a geisha dinner, you know, geisha dinner party. And the babe gets there and starts taking off his clothes. And they said, "No, it's not that kind of a play."
No.
Well, why don't we all give Jay a round of applause to thank him for the. Just to tell the people on the podcast, the Baseball Gallery at 67 East 11th Street is a lovely space in a lovely city in New York. But if you love baseball and art, as many people do, my brother-in-law Tom Meyer has lovely pictures of the early baseball in the Negro Leagues, which he'd love to see this space. It's worth, when you come to New York, to come to the Baseball Gallery, ask for Jay. I think you'll be able to find him in the gallery. But what's nice about the gallery is it has the expansive feel of the upper deck. So we thank you, Jay, for hosting us tonight.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and one of the pleasures of every day is not necessarily filled with pleasures in the clubhouse, but one of the pleasures that I do have is you never know what's going to happen when that door swings open on a New York City street, who's going to walk in and what's then going to happen. And when I met you more than a year ago now, probably for the first time,
yes,
when you walked in, I believe with your daughter at that time.
Yes.
And we just started to talk, and eventually we got to tonight. And never did I imagine that we would have this discussion and that you would talk about your grandmother taking you to your first game. And then when I asked you about your favorite ballpark, it happens to be the field of Princeton University. And that's one of the satisfying and beautiful things for me is that I get to meet people like you and hear these beautiful stories. And it takes me back to a time that either I didn't know or that maybe I knew a bit of or that I wish I knew. And I really appreciate your time and that your friends came out to support you. And it's been an absolute pleasure. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff.